We step into the masterclass. Now, just to tell you briefly about my guest for the masterclass. And as you know, this is where we make time to immerse ourselves in a particular subject matter. And you can always suggest the varying topics, and you can email azania@702.co.za. That's the email address. And today we're exploring the world of astronauts. Dr. Donald Thomas is an American engineer. He's also a former NASA astronaut. He is a veteran of 4 shuttle missions, and he has logged over 1,000 hours in space. He's orbited the Earth nearly 700 times, and this was during his 20 years with NASA. So he's been spending many of the past couple of years doing public speaking, giving lectures, and most importantly, inspiring the youth to pursue mathematics and science subjects. So he's in South Africa for the Living Maths Space Tour, which will see him give a series of public talks and school addresses. He's been to Cape Town. He's in Johannesburg right now, and then he'll move on to Durban. Durban often complains that they always get forgotten. This time around, they haven't. So he'll move on to Cape Town, or rather Durban, after his time here in Johannesburg. So what would you like to know? What would you like to know about astronauts and what it is, what it's like to be out in space? You're welcome to pose your questions and your comments on 011-883-0702. I think this year has certainly belonged to what is happening in space. When I think of the variety of guests that we've had, the experts who have come out who've been quite open about the experiences, when you think of even the portals on the NASA website and this mission to Mars, how publicly accessible it's all been. And it's a question that I keep bringing up and over again, that never in my 40 years do I remember a time where we've seen this level of openness about what is actually going on beyond the heavens, beyond our atmosphere. So it's certainly very, very exciting. And hopefully this will inspire a new generation as we push the limits as to what humanity can do. Good afternoon, Dr. Thomas. What do I call you? Astronaut Thomas?
You can call me Don.
Don. So I see that a lot of crews tend to give each other nicknames. Did you ever get one?
On my second mission, we had a nickname for our crew. It was called the Woodpecker Crew. Because 1 week before our scheduled mission aboard Space Shuttle Discovery, a single woodpecker attacked our space shuttle and drilled 205 holes in the big orange fuel tank. It delayed our mission by a month, so we got that nickname as the Woodpecker Crew. This is how I'm famous in my career. And we had a lot of woodpecker jokes during the mission, and it was a lot of fun.
Sure. So where did it all start for you, the fascination, the desire to be an astronaut?
You know, I remember that moment so clearly. I was 6 years old, and I was watching the launch of the first American into space at my primary school. And as soon as that astronaut was up in space, I remember sitting there saying, I want to do that. Mm. So ever since I was 6 years old, I always knew I wanted to be an astronaut, fly in space. I wanted to experience zero gravity. So it was a lifelong dream of mine, and one that I worked, you know, towards that goal for many, many years. I was 39 years old when I first made it to space. And that's a long time from a six-year-old boy just dreaming of that. But it was a lot of hard work, took a long time. But it was so worth it in the end.
Oh, wow. And you, in your talks, you often talk about how at times people would laugh at you. They would laugh when you said, I want to be an astronaut.
I would tell my friends in high school, I want to be an astronaut. I want to walk on the moon. And they would laugh. They'd say, oh, you can't do that. Uh-huh. You're not smart enough, tall enough, whatever enough. And after a while, I stopped telling people what I wanted to do. My close friends, my family knew for sure, mm-hmm. but I didn't advertise it anymore. I just quietly kept working, you know, getting my university degrees and just trying to improve my background to put me in a position where I might be successful getting accepted into the program.
Well, Clay Anderson talks about the fact that he had to try 15 times. 15.
Right.
For 15 years, he just kept, or 14 years, and then the 15th time he got in. How many times did you try to get in?
There were 4 astronaut selections that I applied for, and I finally got in the 4th time. And it's not unusual for astronauts to get rejected 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or for Clay, you know, 15 times there. Mm-hmm. We joke that NASA turns you down the first time just to see if you want it bad enough. That's not true, but it sure seems like that for most of us. I know a few astronauts that applied and they got in the very first time.
I see.
But that's a great minority of the applications.
Yes. So what did you then have to do? Because, and also just what are the qualifications? What do they look for? You talked about height earlier on. We'll look at those requirements, but what do they look for?
You know, the basic requirements for NASA to select you as an astronaut are fairly simple. They want a 4-year college degree, university degree in the maths, science, engineering, or the medical field, and 4 years of related work experience. That's for the mission specialist science astronauts. Which I am.
Mm-hmm.
And then for our pilot astronauts, typically they come out of the military. They're required to have 2,000 or 3,000 hours of jet flying experience, and again, a bachelor's degree. But the competition is really tough.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see most of the applicants far exceed the minimum requirements. And that's what I try to do. I stayed in university, not just to get my bachelor's degree, but I got my master's and doctorate, hoping that maybe I can distinguish myself and separate me from a lot of other candidates applying.
Yes. So in the U.S. with NASA, because we have different space agencies, this criteria will vary. So it's either you went through the civil route, and
right.
Some people
yes.
go through the military route.
Right. Well, they both come down through NASA.
Mm-hmm.
The military astronauts come through NASA as well.
Okay.
So our military astronauts get assigned to NASA, you know, for their military career.
Mm-hmm.
So it all comes through NASA. But we have, coming up, we have private companies that will be selecting astronauts to fly in space. And
yes.
each country, you know, the Canadians, the Europeans, the Japanese, the Russians, all countries, you know, have their own individual astronaut corps and then their own selection process.
Right.
But I think they're fairly similar from country to country.
Yes, and as you say, there's now this private route that we're going to see an increase in. So this pool, it feels like a very exclusive club. Exclusive in the sense that it's very few people in the world. It's one of the toughest, hardest jobs to get into, and that it's not very common. So you're not going to find massive numbers of people walking around saying, "Ah, yeah, I'm an astronaut." Just as we get, "Yes, I'm a doctor. I'm an engineer."
I have a lot of friends who are astronauts, so it doesn't seem so rare to me.
But relative to the general population.
About 550 people have flown in space over the last 50-some years from all the countries around planet Earth.
Yeah.
So it's not a dozen group, you know, a dozen or two of people, 550, but it is still, it's a much smaller group than our professional football players in the United States on any given moment. You know,
right.
We have more football players than we have had astronauts fly in space.
Mm-hmm. So you have to pass very demanding physical tests. What do they look for?
You know, when you interview to be an astronaut, you go down to the NASA Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas, and you spend a full week on a very thorough medical exam.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking at your heart, you know, your blood work, your brain waves, your muscle strength. You talk to psychologists and psychiatrists. They try to get inside your head and see what kind of person are you, what motivates you. There's just a wide range of different selection.
Mm-hmm.
They check your hearing and there's just so many tests. Some of them, I don't know what they're looking for. One of them that was a little unusual, they want to test you for claustrophobia.
Yes.
To see, can you withstand small spaces? So what they would do, they take us into a room. They wire us up for our breathing and heart rate, and they monitor that. And then they have a small canvas ball, a sphere,
yeah.
with a zipper on it. And it's only maybe less than a meter across. And they say, get inside of that, and they zip it up. And there's a little tiny air hole, maybe a centimeter across, where they blow air into. And they turn the lights off, and they say, we'll be back later.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were claustrophobic, that is a great moment to panic. But for me, the way I felt, it's like, hey, relax. They're not taking blood. There's a lot more testing that was totally uncomfortable. This is not that bad.
Mm.
But that is a good screener for people who are claustrophobic.
Sure.
And that's just one of the many tests that they do on us.
Right. So does the love of flying help? Because you are wearing your jet suit today, and you also fly. You have quite a number of hours of flying a single aircraft. You fly gliders. Do you think that helps?
It definitely helps. It's not a requirement
mm-hmm.
to be an astronaut, especially one of the science mission specialists like myself. But in the competition, I tracked the numbers. I looked at who was NASA selecting, who are they not selecting.
Right.
And after I'd been turned down twice, I realized they're looking for people with flying experience. So I got my pilot's license. I got certified for skydiving. I taught a university course. I did all these things to try to enhance my background to make myself a better candidate. And flying was definitely one of those. Anybody interested in being an astronaut, I always tell them, hey, take a few flying lessons. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have a 1,000 hours, 10,000 hours. Just show NASA that you have the drive and the willingness to go up in a plane.
You're right.
And you have an interest in learning how to fly. That's what they're looking for.
Have things changed in terms of what they're looking for? Because obviously there've been technological advancements, the kind of missions that we need to go on, the kind of experiments that need doing. Are you finding different sets of skills in the crews that are going up now?
You know, I don't think it's changed that much.
Okay.
Over the 30-year of the space shuttle program, we've got military pilots that command the mission and fly the vehicles, and then we have our science astronauts, and they train the scientists for deploying satellites and doing spacewalks and doing the science on board. But the missions coming up in the future, in the next decade or two, when we're talking about sending astronauts back to the moon and onto Mars, you know, 20, 25 years from now, then I think you have a different set of skills that you're looking for.
Yeah.
When you go to Mars, you're going to need at least one medical doctor. You're going to need one person who's like a Mr. or Mrs. Fix-It, who can fix anything that breaks down, where you might not necessarily need that on the space shuttle on a short mission. So there's going to be a new set of skills, maybe a geologist
yes.
going to Mars, somebody to study the rocks there. So there'll be a whole host of different skills, because these missions going into deep space and being so far removed from Earth
mm-hmm.
where you have to be more independent, it's going to be vital.
Mm. So I want to know what it's like. As I said, this is part of the scope of our conversation today. Just hearing that countdown, that this is going to happen in a matter of seconds, 10 seconds and counting. And then the engines are fired up. You know that your loved ones are watching it with great anticipation and anxiety because you're in this craft. So what's going through your mind? What happens to you?
You know, in the last maybe 2 minutes of the countdown before we launch, the computers can stop the vehicle at any time, could stop the countdown if they see something that doesn't look right. But for me, I had the sense of time was accelerating. Every second was shorter than the one before it. And it's almost like when you're falling in the air and you're accelerating, going faster and faster every second. I had this feeling, the sensation that time is just, it is going so fast. Every second is just shorter than the one before it.
Right.
And as we're coming up on the countdown, you know, you're hoping everything looks good, that the computers are happy. Right at 6 seconds before liftoff, the engines come up to full power. We're still physically bolted down to the launch pad at that point, but you can feel the vibration. You can hear the roar of the engines. And then once the computers like those three big engines, what they look like, then we light two additional booster rockets, and immediately you take off. And I'm laying on my back in my seat, and it felt to me like somebody had their hand right in the middle of my back, and they were just pushing me up into the sky. And on my first mission, I have to tell you, I dreamed of this for 33 years.
Mm-hmm.
And when I felt that push in my back, once you feel that, you know you have taken off. You know you're going somewhere that day, and there's no turning back. There's no shutting down the engines. And when I felt that push on my first mission, I had my helmet on, visor down. Nobody in the world could hear me. And I'm screaming inside my helmet, "Yahoo, let's go!" You know, because this was the dream of my life. And it was taking place right in front of my eyes. It was such an incredible moment. There were three other astronauts on that crew that were mm-hmm. flying for the first time. I would pretty much bet that they were screaming inside their helmets too, because there's a lot of hard work, a lot of time, 4 years of training for that first mission. So when you actually know you're on your way, you're heading to space,
mm.
it's an awesome moment.
Oh my. It sounds exhilarating, just the way you've described it. So how long does it take to get into space?
In the space, it's an unbelievable quick trip, 8.5 minutes. Sometimes you look for, you know, a parking spot in Joburg for longer than that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And in 8.5 minutes, you launch, the engines shut down, and you're 300 kilometers above the Earth, traveling at 28,000 kilometers an hour. And it all happens in a short span of 8.5 minutes.
328 kilometers, you said.
About 300 kilometers up.
300 kilometers.
And 28,000 kilometers an hour is our speed once we get to space.
Mm-hmm.
Like 7 kilometers a second. That's how fast we're traveling.
Incredible.
And we orbit the Earth every 90 minutes, every hour and a half.
Wow. So from the time I started the show at 1 o'clock, and when we get to the bottom of the hour at 2:30, an orbit could have been complete.
We could have completed
in 90 minutes.
One full orbit of the Earth. On my first mission, we had gotten to space, we had launched, and we were just starting to get out of our spacesuits. And I happened to be near the window, and I looked out, and I could see Florida coming up. And I stayed at the window, and 3 seconds later, we were passing over the Kennedy Space Center, where we had just launched like 90 minutes before. And one of the thoughts that hit my, you know, hit me in the head was, I have just been around the Earth one time, and my family is still in traffic waiting to get back to their hotels after seeing the launch. And it just put it in perspective of where we are, where I was, and what I was doing up there.
That sounds incredible. We're going to take a break. And then when we come back, there's more, of course, to unpack with Dr. Donald Thomas. We're just calling him Don, astronaut, former astronaut with, retired, I should say, with NASA. And we'll take your calls on for the masterclass on 011-883-0702.
702. Masterclass.
We're back with retired astronaut Dr. Don Thomas. He's an American engineer, and he's here in South Africa as part of Living Math Space Tour. We'll talk about some of the conversations that he's been having with the kids, especially around inspiring them to enjoy and love maths and science and technology. And that's coming up later. But first, let's take your call, Robert. You're out in Alberton. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you, Zanya?
Very good, Robert. Go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to ask Dr. Don, when they launch and when they return to Earth, what is the G-forces experienced on the body, number one? And number two, when they orbit, do they orbit in a pattern north to south, west to east, or is it erratic?
Right.
Okay, good questions, Robert. Our G-force during launch on the space shuttle is about 3 times the force of gravity. So it's not that much. It kind of feels like somebody's sitting on your chest, pinning you down. It's a little harder to breathe, a little uncomfortable, but it's not painful. You're not gasping for air. During landing, when we come back to Earth, it's only 1.5 times the force of gravity here on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels more like 10 because you've been floating around weightless, and it just feels a lot heavier coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And when we launch, we always go west to east, almost always, because we take advantage of the natural spin of the Earth.
Yes.
And it gives you a little momentum and a little velocity to start off with. If you went the other direction, you would not be able to take advantage of that. You'd need more fuel to do the same orbit in space.
Mm. Robert, satisfied?
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you for your question. There's another one on the SMS line, and maybe we should just knock this one out as quick as possible. What would your guests say about people that believe that the moon landing is fake?
Yeah, I wasn't on the moon. Only 12 astronauts, you know, landed on the moon between 1969 and 72, and I was not one of them. I firmly believe we landed on the moon, and if anybody doesn't want to believe that, I think that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
People have these different beliefs. We have images of the landing sites with detailed spacecraft, high-definition cameras, and you can see the landers. You can see the cars we left behind on the moon. You can see the trail where Neil Armstrong walked to a crater on the moon when he was on the surface back in 1969. So there's a lot of evidence out there. I think the best evidence, one of the Apollo astronauts said, can you imagine 176,000 Americans keeping a secret like this? Not possible.
Not possible.
We had to have gone to the moon.
I guess those that don't want to believe don't have to believe, as you said. They're welcome to keep their beliefs.
702. Masterclass.
Gosh, we are just listening to some fascinating insights about being an astronaut with Dr. Donald Thomas, who's in the country as part of the Living Maths Space Tour initiative. So he's been speaking to learners all over the country to get them passionate about the subject of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. There are a couple of things that I want to just pick up on before we move on from previous, some of the things that we've touched on. So we had the passing of Dick Gordon recently, who was part of that generation, that Neil Armstrong generation, even though he was never on the moon himself. Have you met any of those legends?
I've met all the Apollo astronauts, the Gemini astronauts, Mercury astronauts. I met many of the early Soviet Union astronauts, you know, Russian astronauts. So I've had the great opportunity during my career to meet many of my childhood heroes. One of them was Neil Armstrong. He grew up in the state of Ohio, which is where I'm from, and he was always my hero. The night he was on the moon, when he climbed back in the lunar lander, I remember going outside in my backyard and I'm looking up at the moon thinking, wow, there's 2 people up on the surface of the moon. It just blew me away.
Mm.
And for my third launch, I wrote Neil Armstrong a letter and invited him to come down to see the launch, told him he was one of my heroes. And he wrote back, said, I'll be there. And it's like, wow, Neil Armstrong's going to come to my launch. And it was one day before our scheduled launch, I got a call from NASA management, and they said Mr. Armstrong wanted to meet with me. So I got to spend about an hour one-on-one with Neil Armstrong, which was one of the coolest things I've ever done in my life.
Yeah.
Flying in space was great, but meeting Neil Armstrong was right up there to meet your childhood hero. And when we were saying goodbye to one another, I shook his hand and said, thank you for being here. You know, it really means a lot to me. And I asked him, how long are you staying in town? Meaning, how long are you going to be in Florida for? And he looked back at me, he said, how long are you in Florida for? Meaning, I'm going to stay here until you launch. And to have him say that to me was just incredible.
Oh, that's so precious. It's incredibly precious. Let's go next to Andrew holding from Benoni. Hello, Andrew.
Hi. I never thought I'd speak to an astronaut on the phone. But anyway, it must be absolutely amazing to go into space. I tend to show my daughter quite a lot of little videos about the space shuttle launching, and she just finds it fascinating. But anyway, my question is regarding SpaceX and just your opinion on a few things. I've got two questions. The first one is, what do you think the complexity is of landing three first-stage rockets back on Earth when they launched this Falcon Heavy 9? And the second question is, Elon Musk was talking about the ability or the possibility in the future of being able to travel anywhere in the world in about an hour's time. Of course, using space travel. What do you think the viability of that might be? Right. I'll listen on the radio.
Thank you for your questions, Andrew. Let's also go to Daryl in Sandton. Hi, Daryl. Hi, Daryl.
Yes. I've got a question for Don. Mm-hmm. I would like to know, with all the billions of dollars that's been spent through the years of putting man on the moon and exploring in space and trying to go to Mars, how has that all that money that's been spent helped us on this planet, this Earth?
Right. Thank you, Daryl. I think that's also a question that other people similar who've worked in the space have also answered previously. Do you want to start with that one?
Yeah. You know, it's a frequent question that we get. How can you justify spending any money on going into space when there's homeless, when there's hungry people, when there's people in need of medical attention? And it's a tough question to answer, but you know, what we do as human beings, we're a unique species, and we explore. That's something that separates us from all other species. We climb mountains, we cross oceans, you know, we explore the planet, and we're exploring space. So it's something we do, and the budget for NASA is a small fraction of the United States budget. You know, when we went to the moon, it was 2 or 3% of our budget. Today, it's about 0.5%. Mm. So we don't just focus on the hungry or the homeless. We also spend money on education. We spend money on healthcare. We spend money on the arts, supporting the arts and the sciences. And I think the greatest benefit that I've ever seen of the space program is the inspiration that it provides to young children.
Mm-hmm.
I was 6 years old, you know, when I got inspired to be an astronaut, and it propelled me in my career to do my best, to become an engineer, to get my PhD in university. And the space program today is still inspiring students, just like it did for me.
Mm-hmm.
Whether those students are in the United States or here in Joburg or Cape Town, or I'm sure in Durban as well, I see that same spark in their eye when you start talking to them about space and the possibility of becoming an astronaut or an engineer or a scientist. That is a great benefit. It's hard to put a dollar price tag on that.
To something like that.
To what the value of that is, but it's very powerful.
Mm. And then Andrew's question, the complexity of landing the three crafts by SpaceX.
That's a difficult challenge. And if you had asked me, 3 or 4 years ago, could Elon Musk bring down the first stage and land it? It was like, wow, that's really hard to do. He's demonstrated over and over he can successfully do that.
Mm-hmm.
I happened to be at the Kennedy Space Center when he brought down the very first stage, and he successfully landed it. And I was 10 miles away watching the flame as it's falling back to Earth. And I thought to myself, I'm watching history here to bring back a first stage. So he can do that. I have every confidence, no doubt, that he can bring the three first stages down. And
the travel, international travel via space.
International travel. I think I've learned to not question what Elon Musk says he can and cannot do.
Right.
I think the smart money is, bet on him.
But does it make sense? The 8.5, what, minutes up, and then, you know, say we want to get to Japan.
You know, sometimes you develop a capability, and it's a great one technologically, but it doesn't make sense.
Mm.
You know, the Concorde was one of those projects where, you know, we could get from London to New York City or Washington, D.C. In a, you know, two or three hours, half the time. And it just was so fuel inefficient and polluting the atmosphere. So, I mean, ultimately, you look at it and say, this is really great. We have that capability. Is there a need for this in our planet, you know, on Earth? So should we do it or not?
Right. Jabu, you're out in Fourways. You also have a question. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. Welcome, Jabu.
Yeah, I want to ask John a question here in terms of when they get into space, do they ever get sewn into secrecy by government in case they might see something out there that might cause a panic here back on Earth or maybe extraterrestrials? But my basic question is, do they get sewn into secrecy that when they come back, they can't disclose anything to the public before they get debriefed by NASA or whatever and the like?
Okay, done.
We have never been briefed. I've never been told you cannot say anything about this or that about my travels into space.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a few military space shuttle missions. They've deployed like a spy satellite from the space shuttle. On those flights, it's definitely top secret. But every other mission that we would fly, and all four of my flights, they're totally open flights. You can see every picture that the astronauts took. They're all online. And there's no secrets. They don't tell us when we come back, make sure you don't discuss the alien you saw up there. I don't know any astronaut that's seen any alien life or other spacecraft up there. We see weird lights flashing sometimes, but you can usually explain them away. On my first mission, I saw a light flashing once a second, and it was flying with us next to the shuttle.
Yeah.
And I studied it for 10 minutes and realized I was looking at a big piece of ice that had come off the engines.
Mm.
And it was flipping in the air, and the sunlight hitting it gave you that flashing.
Ah, much so, like you would in traffic, or if the light is hitting. Or, yeah, I see what you're saying,
the reflection
of the light. Yeah,
and it had a flat side on the ice, and it was like a mirror hitting it.
And every time it turned,
Every time it turned. So we see strange things, but I don't know anybody who's seen any aliens.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the universe is so huge. There are so many galaxies, billions of galaxies, each with 10 billion stars. We think every star has multiple planets, that I do believe that there's other life in the universe, but we have not seen it yet.
Right. So tell me about some of the experiments, that you conducted, because you are a science astronaut, you're a mission specialist. So you were carrying out certain experiments on board.
Yeah, during a two-week space shuttle mission, we would typically do maybe 100 to 200 different experiments from researchers across the United States and around the world. And they all involve looking into the effects of zero gravity.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you look into how a flame burns in space. A flame doesn't come up to a point that we're used to seeing because hot air doesn't rise in space.
Uh-huh.
So a flame will burn perfectly round.
Wow.
Liquids in space, if you squirt out a liquid, it'll form a perfectly round ball and just float there.
Mm-hmm.
And we study, that's an effect called surface tension. We study that in space. We take up many small plants and animals up there to see how they behave, how they adapt and grow. I've flown with jellyfish, goldfish, salamanders, rats, fruit flies, a whole host of different animals that I've flown up there with. And we're always looking at to learn, you know, how does a plant know which way the roots should grow down?
Mm-hmm.
They grow down on Earth because of gravity. What are they thinking in space? You know, how do they know which way to grow?
Yeah, because there's no up or down. Yeah.
So some of the research we do has application on Earth. We study the muscle loss and bone loss of the astronauts, which many senior citizens, like I'm getting to be, experience. And there's other research that we do, and it's just basic research, just for the knowledge of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how does a salamander behave in space, or how does a jellyfish decide which way is up or down?
Right.
How does that impact our life down here? It doesn't, but it's just basic knowledge, you know, for the overall, you know, knowledge of our planet.
Here's a question. I think it's appropriate to raise it now. Is it true that everyone throws up in space?
And not everybody.
Okay. Yeah,
but it is true. About a third of the astronauts get what we call space sickness.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the symptoms are the same as seasick, carsick, airsick. but it's totally unrelated.
Are they barf bags all over the
place? They're barf bags. We carry them in our spacesuit out to the launch pad because you never know when it's going to hit you. It could suddenly hit you. If you turn around and you see your colleague sitting up on the ceiling, it can disorient you and give you vertigo, maybe feel a little dizzy. So we're very careful the first day or two, and typically that's as long as it passes for most astronauts. For me, on my first mission, I felt like I had an upset stomach. I didn't want to eat the first day, but the next morning I was fine. And I've been up in space with astronauts that were throwing up so much that they could not do any useful work for the first day or two.
Yes.
And then in that case, the other astronauts, we all pitch in, okay, what are you supposed to be working on? And we'll help you. You just, you know, take a day, get adjusted up here, and then everybody feels better.
Yeah. So let's go to George, and then we'll get into some of the other questions. George in Maritzburg, good afternoon.
Yeah, sadly, life intrudes even in outer space. There was a movie recently about the unacknowledged role of some black woman scientists in the calculations.
Mm-hmm.
What is the situation now, and is there a fair role for people of color?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for that, George. That movie, that,
The Hidden Figures,
the Hidden
is what
Figures.
George is referring
That's
to there.
It.
An excellent movie, a great movie as a role model for young women in the United States, especially you know, young African-American women. And in the NASA program, I worked there for 20 years. I think they've done an outstanding job recruiting minorities. In the astronaut program, when I was a young boy, it was only male test pilots, only men flying. And then the era of the space shuttle, we started selecting women, Sally Ride, the first American woman in space, and many other women. On every flight that I flew on space, there was always a woman on board. And we have women of color, men and women of color as well. I was a CAPCOM in Mission Control when Mae Jemison, the first African-American woman, flew on her flight.
Mm-hmm.
I got to talk to her during her mission in the space. So in every astronaut class, I keep seeing the diversity increasing and increasing. And it represents more of the population of the United States. So I think we're heading in the right direction.
Right.
It isn't 50-50 yet with women, but we are getting there.
Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you for your question, George. But, you know, movies have also influenced what we perceive and what we think space is like. When you think of Gravity, I mean, the movie centers around a bad day in space. You know, so if I had bad days in space? What are bad days? Because that's a hectic bad day, if ever there is such.
We've had a bad day. Apollo 13 was one of the worst days that we had. And the astronauts were about a day and a half away from Earth, you know, approaching the moon. And they had an oxygen tank explode and almost did not make it back to Earth. It was only through the efforts of the ground team and Mission Control that they successfully brought them back. That was a really bad day. But when it was over, we call it a successful failure. We demonstrated we can bring them back. They probably should have died out there,
yeah.
You know, but they did the impossible and figured a way to bring those astronauts home. The space shuttle was really well designed. It has backup systems, like your car has a spare tire in case you get a flat. The space shuttle has many oxygen tanks. If one of them leaks, we've got many others.
The toilet breaks,
we've got backup solutions for that. Not great ones, but we've got backup solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And if your communication goes down, so we've had two bad days on the space shuttle. Both of those were horrific accidents. One space shuttle Challenger in January of 1986, it was launching, and just a minute and a half into the launch, it blew up.
Mm-hmm.
All seven astronauts died. We lost the vehicle. And then in 2003, we lost space shuttle Columbia and the crew of seven. So those are really, really bad days. Not only do you lose your space shuttle, you know, you lose seven astronauts, and on Space Shuttle Columbia, there were seven really good friends of mine. And to realize, oh, we just lost them. They're gone.
Mm.
This is part of what it is, the risk that you take being an astronaut. So you know that. But when you lose these friends and colleagues, it hurts.
And off air, you were saying, one of the kids are asking you some really fascinating questions. And one of them thought, it's a great job. It's a great organization to work for. Why retire?
Why retire? Why would you ever leave being an astronaut? And when I first got selected to be an astronaut, they brought in one of the veteran astronauts who had been there for 5 or 6 years. And his number one advice to us was, plan your exit. And I thought, he's crazy. I'm going to stay here forever.
Mm.
You know, I worked too hard to get here. This is such a great job. But on every mission, every time you fly in space, you are taking a risk. There was about a 1 in 65 chance that if you launched on the shuttle, you might not get back to Earth. We had two bad accidents out of 135 missions. Mm. And so that's in the back of your head. It's probably going to work okay. But there may be an accident, right. And you just have to know that. So I flew four times, and you start thinking, you know, I've been on the shuttle four times. I would take the risk and go to the moon. I would take the risk to go to Mars. But it just got to the point where I think I'm comfortable staying on Earth, that I wouldn't get as much out of that fifth flight into space, you know, in comparison, weighing it against taking that risk.
Right. Let's go to the lines before we wrap up. Ricky in Sunning Hill, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yes, Ricky.
Don, just a quick two questions. The first one is, the previous caller said, why are we spending all this money? Would you agree, without having spent that money, you wouldn't have had satellite communication today?
Yeah, satellite communication, weather satellites, you probably wouldn't have miniaturized electronics, your cell phone technology. Yeah. There are so many spinoffs that come from the space program as well. So I absolutely agree with you, Ricky.
Okay. And your second one, Ricky?
The second one is, Felix Burmeister did a jump from 100 and I think it was 12,000 feet. At what stage is it not possible to eject or abort from the shuttle? Should you have to? I mean, you're 112. What would be the furthest limit, in your opinion?
Yeah, probably in the space shuttle, you know, we could eject out. It would be, you know, 30, 40,000 feet, so maybe 10,000 meters or so. We only carry a few minutes of oxygen. So if you're falling back to Earth and you're parachuting down, if you're up too high, you don't have enough oxygen for that. So our escape mechanism, you know, our bailout, we call it, to jump out of the shuttle, there's only a narrow window where you could really use that. It's fairly low to the Earth, and you need to be in a nice, stable glide with the space shuttle. So if for some reason we couldn't get to our runway, we could open the side hatch and jump out and parachute down. But we could not do it like Felix did and you know, some other individuals too high up.
Due to that oxygen restriction. But this landing, it also has to be very, very precise.
The landing is incredibly precise, and it almost blows your mind. We fire an engine halfway around the world. The space shuttle falls back to Earth, and we land maybe a few meters from our exact targeted touchdown point. And the nose of the shuttle would land just maybe 10 or 20 centimeters off the center line of the runway.
Sure.
And it's a tribute to our excellent pilots that fly the space shuttle. We had some of the best Navy and Air Force military pilots, and also great technology. We got really good navigation and computers, you know, that bring us in for the landings.
Mm-hmm. We've got Gloria and Benoni. Good afternoon, Gloria.
Good afternoon. Hello, John. Just a quick question. Can you just briefly describe from your point of view what the Earth looks like from space, how it looked like to you, and why would a group of people maintain that the Earth is not round but flat?
It's flat. Thank you, Gloria.
I'm afraid, Gloria, I can't answer that second question. I don't know why anybody would believe it's flat with all we know. Like I said, I've been around the Earth 692 times. Every single orbit, it was round. Never flat, not on one of those.
Yeah.
And the first question?
It was about the Earth and what it looks like from space.
Yeah, what does it look like? Great question. And, you know, I had seen pictures of the Earth from the astronauts before I flew on my first mission. But when I went up there the first time, I floated to the window. I gasped at the beauty of the Earth. You just go, wow, it's so incredible. And the sky in space, the blackness of that color is darker than any color I've ever seen. Mm. It was like almost a glowing, fluorescent, velvety black color. Mm. And right up against that blackness of space, you see the edge of the Earth with our thin, thin atmosphere, paper thin. And it's glowing like a fluorescent blue light. And it's just an incredible contrast between pitch black and right there, the blue atmosphere. And looking out the window of the space shuttle, It's similar in comparison to being in a jet airliner, you know, high up, and you're looking down out the window, and you may see a city or two below you. Maybe you see Joburg and, you know, Pretoria there. In the space shuttle, you look out the window and you see multiple countries instead. Mm-hmm. You're just higher up. And we're traveling 28,000 kilometers an hour. You have no sense of speed because you're not passing any stop signs or stores, anything else. But you can tell by looking out the window, you know, only takes maybe 6 or 7 minutes to cross Africa. It takes 15 minutes across the Pacific Ocean. Mm-hmm. Then you know you're traveling fast.
Oh.
But I've seen sites like the top of Mount Everest. I've seen huge you know, volcanoes and hurricanes down below. I've seen Victoria Falls, Mount Kilimanjaro, just so many amazing sights. And to see them with your own eye from space, not in a book, not in a magazine, but you're looking out the window and you're looking down on the top of Mount Everest, that was always a special moment for me.
So what does it do to your perception of humanity and of Earth? Does it change it somehow?
Two things drastically change for every astronaut. I think if you asked anybody who went to space, they would come back and tell you the same thing. The first change is how you view the fragility of planet Earth. Our planet is really fragile, very thin atmosphere. And you can see what we're doing to the planet, the cutting and burning of the rainforest. You know, the pollution that we send down rivers that dumps into oceans. You can see that with your eye from space.
Mm-hmm.
So you come back with a keen appreciation. We need to take better care of planet Earth. The second thing that changes is your view of where you fit in on the planet. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, in the northern United States, and I used to identify myself. I would say I'm from Cleveland, and that's how I identified myself. Today, I tell people I'm from Earth. And it doesn't matter to me what city you're from, what country, what continent, what religion or language you speak, that I see all of us here as more similar than different. And I think we all have an important role to take better care of this planet. So I see sometimes the competition between different cities in sport events or for other things going on, or even different countries.
Yeah.
And I think this is silly. This is silly. We are all Earthlings here, and we need to work together more.
Wow. I think that's a really powerful note to end it off on. Are the talks that are happening in Johannesburg strictly for the school kids? People can get their tickets as well. You can purchase your tickets. Go to Web Tickets. And there is one tonight. This is at Saxon World Primary from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. So why not go through? It'll cost you between 50 Rand and 80 Rand with family tickets available as well. So you can come and listen to Don speak. Yesterday he was at a primary school. Today he's at Saxon World Primary in the evening from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. So go along and really indulge in a little bit more, I guess a whole lot more. You just had a little bit now of the experience of being an astronaut.
We'll share with them what it's like up in space.
Yes.
We also have time for questions. We take pictures. We'll sign autographs. So I'd love to meet everybody, invite everybody to come on out. I have seen South Africa many times from space, mm-hmm. passed overhead. But I've been to South Africa four visits, and this is my first visit to Johannesburg. And I'm so impressed with the warmth of the people. You know, I've made so many new friends, and just in your city here, let alone Cape Town,
yeah.
And I know I will in Durban as well. And it's one of my favorite places on planet Earth. So I invite everybody, come on out tonight.
Absolutely.
To Saxon World Primary.
Absolutely. So get your tickets from Web Tickets. Don, it was a pleasure. Thank you for leading our masterclass.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.